Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimenchu, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Sam, and our producer, soon to be, and probably when this episode's out, Dr. Trevor Hoog.
Yeah!
Hi, guys.
Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
Tonight, we have Dr. Basil Williams to discuss retinoblastoma. But first, Sam, do you remind us about what this show is about?
I would love to. So, we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering limiting questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We had a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Basil Williams. Dr. Williams is an associate professor of ophthalmology at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, Florida, where he specializes in both ocular oncology and vitreoretinal diseases and surgery. He holds leadership positions in a number of organizations, including the American Academy of Ophthalmology, the American Society of Retina Specialists, and the National Medical Association. His research interests include health equity, vitreoretinal surgical topics, as well as both pediatric and adult surface and intraocular tumors. Today, he teaches us about common presentation, management, and treatment options for pediatric retinoblastoma.
Can't wait to talk about this topic. You know, we shouldn't turn a blind eye to this important condition. You know, it's time for us to really see the bigger picture here. Let's focus our lens on today's topic, guys. All right, that's it.
That's it. That's definitely enough. All right.
Dr. Williams, thank you for coming on the show. But first, because we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Yes, please do. Basil, absolutely.
Excellent. Excellent. So, you know, just to warm up, to get to know you a little better, for our audience to get to know you a little better, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, a couple sentences about who you are, maybe something outside of medicine that you'd like to do?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So I'm a Caribbean American New Yorker. I was born in St. George's, Grenada, and I grew up in New York. No matter where I live, I must claim and rep New York. And then from a work perspective, I'm a retina specialist, ocular oncologist, researcher, and educator. And all of those things, I think, are equally important. And then I am very much in my heart, a retired athlete, basketball player.
Nice, nice. Trevor gets to go first.
Yeah, I have this really great question. What is the best advice you've ever received as a learner?
Yeah, I think there are probably two things that stand out most. So the first is always remember that the patients are people. I think that has been critical just to kind of remember what's going on in the backstory, the family life, et cetera, for patients. Sometimes we invent our own narratives, and I think that's been helpful. And I think the second thing is visualization of what you're going to do. That's actually something that probably relates more to my sports time. But I think before going to the operating room, I visualize every case, all the potential side effects or complications that can happen. And I think that makes me a lot more relaxed and at ease during the surgery, because if something goes wrong, I've kind of visualized it and I'm kind of ready to navigate it.
Oh, I love both of those. You know, that sort of remembering that patients are people, I think that's something that easily gets lost, especially like when you're in training, like as a resident. I remember, like, you know, each year you sort of kept more jaded. And then, you know, I always have to step back and, you know, for me, you know, especially when you're busy in a clinic or you're busy on the floor or whatnot, you know, it can be so easy. But then, you know, sitting back and be like, you know, I'm taking care of this patient. You know, especially you're like in the hospital, man, they're not having a good day either. Like, so, you know, trying to keep that in mind, like, I think really helps me try to stay centered and understand. And so that's fantastic. And then the visualization, I love that too. I like to think about like the bobsledders from, was it Cool Runnings, when they're all like, you know, left and then right and then left, and then visualizing, like, that's the way I sort of think about that. And I love those visuals.
Yeah. And I'm glad that it brings it, you know, for surgery purposes too. You know, I think we don't bring enough surgeons onto this show as well. So it's nice to kind of get that perspective of like, hey, you're walking through and you're physically doing something. And so therefore you need to visualize it as you move forward. Trevor, you one-upped me quickly before I was able to get through. I did want to hear about your retired basketball career, though. What was what are we talking about here? When did you retire?
So I retired fairly recently, but I should have retired a long time ago. So I played I played basketball in college. I played in Europe for a little bit. And then I just kind of played recreationally. But I was playing recently in Miami, and a couple of ex-pros got on the court, and I realized that my mind and my body were no longer aligned. And I like the idea of making it to work on Monday, so so that's been put to the side.
I think that's when most people call it quits, regardless of what level of playing that you do, from completely professional to semi-professional to amateur. If it's when the body and the mind are not adding up appropriately, that's when it's time to say, time to move to the next. That's awesome, though. Did you, how much travel did you get to do around Europe? Like, how long were you there when you were doing all these things?
So I was there for a little over a year. I traveled some. I was mostly based in southern Switzerland. Traveled to Italy, Germany, France a bit. So it was fantastic.
That's awesome.
What an amazing experience. That's, I mean, I unfortunately was not skilled enough with which to play professional sports, but those are the dreams. Those are the dreams that I still look upon fondly.
I tell you, when my mind and body don't coordinate, it was like the last time I think I got invited to a bachelor party. That was, I definitely was not keeping up with any of my younger friends.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You got to visualize, Chris. You got to visualize.
Yeah, really.
All right. I think we should get into the heart of the matter here. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, let's do it. Whether this is your first episode or you've been listening to us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a pediatrician, FIGS. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in FIGS scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in FIGS too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that FIGS are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine 50 plus times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with FIGS. Now Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off.
All right. So we have Rhett. He is an 18-month-old male who presents with his parents to the outpatient clinic for his well child check. He was born full term via spontaneous vaginal delivery. Mom had routine prenatal care and normal prenatal testing throughout her pregnancy. He's been growing well, meeting both his motor and developmental milestones. Mom says they were on vacation last week, and while she was going through some of their family pictures, Rhett's eyes look two different colors. She shows you the photos, and you see that Rhett's right pupil has a red reflection, while his left pupil has a white reflection. The finding is reproducible when you utilize the ophthalmoscope during your physical exam. Mom denies any eye swelling, eye deviation, trauma, recent illness, or family history of inherited diseases. So, Dr. Williams, the eyes in their exam itself and their management can be nerve-wracking for a lot of clinicians. Can you talk to us about what exactly the physical exam finding it is that mom noticed and we see and what that exactly means?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So thanks for the case scenario. And I think there's a couple of things that it could be, obviously. So when you see a white reflex, the optic nerve is actually white. And so occasionally you can have a normal exam where you see a white reflex. However, when you see that, it is usually something concerning and you want it to be evaluated more. The most concerning thing you're thinking about is retinoblastoma, a type of pediatric cancer, intraocular cancer. And the white reflex is actually the tumor itself. And so you would be visualizing the tumor. The red reflex that you get is actually the blood vessels of the choroid or one of the outer layers of the eye. And so that's what normally fills that color. So if you see a different color, there's potentially something in front of or obscuring the choroid. And, you know, in this situation, it would be potentially retinoblastoma.
And I think that kind of jumps us directly almost into the differential diagnosis of what could be the white thing that's in front of it. So you say, okay, I see blood vessels on this side. I don't see blood vessels on this side. What are our options other than retinoblastoma?
Yeah, so there's a number of things that it could be. There's a bunch of inflammatory conditions. There's some vascular conditions. Pediatric cataract is definitely one of those things. But I think from the perspective of a pediatrician, if you see a white reflex, it's retinoblastoma until proven otherwise. And I think sometimes people are like, well, I don't want it to be cancer. And so maybe let me think about these other things. And I think it's definitely worthwhile to go through the differential retinal vascular conditions, cataract, et cetera. But the most important thing at that point is really getting the patient to see an ophthalmologist as quickly as you can. So that way the diagnosis can be made. Because if it is cancer, that's something that needs to be treated immediately. And so I think that's probably the most important thing.
Yeah, that was going to be my question was sort of, why do we even care about retinoblastoma? And I guess since you sort of answered that a little bit, say I am a parent and, you know, I'm the parent, you're, you know, the pediatrician who's seeing me in clinic and you sort of see this. Obviously, it's worrisome for you, but you also, you know, you want to explain it to the parents without maybe freaking them out too much. How would you sort of, what is your way of explaining this to a parent?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. I think this kind of goes back to the viewing patients as people thing, because sometimes we're thinking about the diagnosis scientifically and we're forgetting the potential impact that these conversations have. So the first thing I tend to say is, well, it seems like there's a difference between the two eyes and what we're seeing when we look in with the light. And in order for us to, well, and there's a number of reasons that could be. One, it could be as simple as the light hitting the nerve, which is completely normal. It's also possible that there could be some abnormalities in the front or the back of the eye that range from benign to things that require surgery to even things that can be cancer. In order for us to get the best idea of what it is, we're going to have to get you to somebody who focuses on this area so that way they can make the diagnosis and help you best. That way you kind of go through the range of things, but I find that if ever I say the word cancer first, almost everything else I say is not heard.
Yeah. And that sounds exactly like a good way to do it. Almost all of our discussions that we have, you do have to say those words, right? You can't just say that this is something that could be something, so go see someone. No, you have to say that this is the case, but you have to kind of, if you walk through all those things and then just say a specialist will come see you, then you can also be kind of in that mindset. I like that a lot. I am going to ask the, you know, kind of the obvious questions. I think we should probably say this to each other and then we can probably move on to the next thing. So like we're talking about retinoblastoma. We're concerned about retinoblastoma. We are referring because retinoblastoma needs to be seen quickly. What is retinoblastoma?
Yeah. So that definitely the most important question. So retinoblastoma is the most common intraocular cancer in children and actually the most common intraocular cancer worldwide of all ages. It is seen somewhere between 1 in 15,000 and 1 in 24,000, depending on where you are in the world. It is a cancer that starts in the retina and actually rapidly divides. So there's a doubling time of about 2 weeks, so it can move pretty quickly. When it's contained in the eye, the survival rate in most high-income countries is around 98%. But if it gets to the nerve or extends outside the eye, the survival rate can decrease to about 50%. So this is one of the reasons why it's really, really important to take care of things quickly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So, you know, our patient here was, 18 months of age. Is this the typical time we might be seeing them? Like, may we see this earlier? Or can we even see this into early childhood?
Yeah, so I think this is probably the most common time that you would see a child with retinoblastoma. And so there are kind of two dividing factors. The older the child is, the less likely they are to have a genetic mutation or a hereditary disease that has been passed on or a spontaneous mutation early in embryogenesis. And so The later they are, the more likely it is to be only one eye affected and only have a single tumor. And that makes sense because they have their other eye that's able to see, allow them to function and move around. If they have both eyes involved, or if they have multiple tumors in the eye, they're more likely to be caught earlier because parents, number one, might have more opportunities to see the white reflex or the leukocoria, or they might be able to notice from behavior that they might not be able to see as well. And so you can see this. Sometimes retinoblastoma can present in utero, which can be seen on ultrasounds, and it can present much later in life. But 95%+ of cases are diagnosed between before 5 years old.
I think that's actually really important about the timing because, you know, we're very good about our newborn exams to make sure that we look in the back of the eye. And then I'm going to be honest with you. And now, good thing I'm a hospitalist, not a primary care doctor, because like I probably don't do a good job looking at these kids' eyes like well past a year of age, you know, just one of the things that comes with whether it be not part of your classic newborn exam anymore versus you hope to see symptoms from other patients. So I actually think this is a good public service announcement to all of us as general pediatricians here.
That's actually hugely important. We have a saying, and there's even an organization, it's called Know the Glow. And so just kind of thinking about the importance of the glow or the white reflex that you see at all well child exams or well child visits. And sometimes if the child is really not cooperative and it's difficult, asking the parents if they take pictures or if they've taken pictures of the child's eyes and if they've seen any difference between the eyes can be really helpful. I've had a number of personal situations where the parents would have noticed it and they didn't think much of it. They didn't bring it up at their exam. And then later on they say, oh, actually, you know, now that you mention it, I realized this some months ago. And so I think that's a good question to bring up.
Awesome. And then I actually, just before we ask a couple more questions about epidemiology, I actually realized we haven't talked about this either. For us who might not be so good at the eye, what is the retina?
And yeah. So the retina is like the movie screen of the eye. It's where the images get projected. So the light comes in through the cornea and the lens bend the light. And the image is then projected onto the retina. So I kind of think of it, if you're looking at a camera, it's like the film of the camera. So all the information gets processed there. It then travels to the optic nerve and then goes up to the brain. And so if you have disruption of this pathway where the information goes to the retina, but you have cancer in that location, you're not going to be able to transmit the image. And that's going to lead to the decrease in vision.
Awesome.
Got it. And then circling back to the epidemiology question. So we were saying earlier, I think it was that it was like occurs in about one in 15,000 to one in 24,000 live births, depending on where you are. Is there like a specific location or ethnicity, race, socioeconomic status that retinoblastoma like disproportionately affects or...
Yeah, looking at the U.S. Population, there is no increased predilection based on sex, ethnicity, race, or socioeconomic status that we have been able to identify. There is some suggestion that in low-income countries, it might be a little bit more common, but we're actually learning a lot more about retinoblastoma across the world with some recent studies, probably within the last 5 to 10 years. And so we're actually getting a better understanding of incidence per country now.
Okay.
Do we see decreased incidence of diagnosis or late diagnosis, especially in our patients that are affected by social determinants of health?
Yes, that's definitely the case. And obviously, a lot of this has to do with access to care. And so patients who come from underrepresented backgrounds may have a higher stage at presentation. And so disease might be more advanced. And that has led to some information that shows that treatment and outcomes can be somewhat different too. And so as across all fields of medicine, improving access to care will be helpful for better outcomes for all of our patients.
And it seems like screening overall, like what we do in the pediatrician's office, it's a pretty sensitive test. If we see leukocoria, at least, you know, it may, you know, sometimes it may not be retinoblastoma, but at least it will get us to the next step to get them to a specialist for further evaluation.
So I think that's actually really, really critical. Testing for the white reflex, or looking for the red reflex, I should say, is extremely important. And as you mentioned, Chris, it is very, very sensitive. And so I just kind of want to put that plug in. And I would also say that, you know, sometimes we try and downplay, or we try to think, oh, maybe I didn't see it, I'm not really sure. If there's any second guessing or if there's any suspicion, it's better safe to send that person to see an ophthalmologist and be sure. Because I have seen a few cases where it wasn't sure, and then it waited till the next well child visit, and at that time it was quite noticeable, or the family noticed a big change in between. And so I think just kind of being on the safer side, one extra exam from the outpatient perspective will be well worth it.
And just to talk a little bit about symptoms wise, you know, and sensitivity of this test, we mentioned that, okay, certainly in a newborn, you're doing this red light reflex and you're looking for leukochoria. Is leukochoria going to come before or after the decreased in vision? Like, are they associated with each other? Are you going to find this kind of finding beforehand? Or are they obviously going to be symptomatic if they're upwards of 5 years old and they can like tell you whether they can see or not? You know, where is the kind of, when we talk about the presentation and the symptoms, where does it kind of fall in the order of doubling time for this retinoblastoma?
The abnormal light reflex is the first thing that you're going to see. First of all, a lot of the younger children are obviously not able to tell you what's going on with their vision. Second, if it's only happening in one eye, they may still be fully functional because the other eye is working very well, and they would never notice that one eye is not working. The other thing is, it depends on where the tumor is in the eye. The center part of the retina, where all your fine focusing, reading, and writing comes from, is called the macula. If a tumor is not in the macula, they may actually have excellent vision and not notice that they have a tumor in the periphery. And so identifying that light reflex can be better than even a patient telling you what's going on if they were old enough to be able to verbalize.
And then just going off of that, like, I know we were saying, you know, young kids can't really verbalize if their vision's been decreased or anything like that. Are there other like associated symptoms that you could see if you might miss a red reflex? Like, can it cause a retinal detachment or like proptosis or strabismus or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So strabismus is one of the most common features that you'll see. And that's basically many of us, our eyes will turn in or out, and our brain kind of helps keep them aligned straight. And so as you're seeing from both eyes, your brain is appreciating the signal that it's getting from both eyes. However, if you have decreased vision in one eye, let's say because there's a tumor in the center of the vision, the eye may turn in or out because the brain is not liking the signal that it's getting. So looking for strabismus can be a really important feature. A lot of the other things that you would see would really be only with advanced disease. So if the tumor has grown so large that it is causing the eye to expand, you might see proptosis or bufthalmos, where the eye is really large. If the tumor has outgrown its blood supply, part of the tumor can become necrotic and release a lot of inflammation. So the eye can become red, very, very inflamed. In those situations, sometimes the eye will be painful. And so even if the child's not able to verbalize, you will understand that they're not feeling well.
Okay.
Hey, Cripsiders listeners, are you a pediatrician ready to focus on what matters most, your patients? Well, the Permanente Medical Group in Northern California is seeking pediatric physicians to join their multidisciplinary practice, serving families across 21 medical centers with an 80-year legacy of excellence. So here's what sets them apart. No RVUs, no billing headaches, no practice overhead, just you providing exceptional care in a physician-led, mission-driven environment. They offer flexible schedules, a competitive salary and benefits package, moving and relocation assistance, and Northern California home buying assistance. Plus, they are PSLF eligible. Whether you're drawn to Northern California's natural beauty, year-round recreational amenities, or vibrant communities, they have locations you'll love to call home. Visit northerncalifornia.permanente.org to learn how you can help them fulfill the promise of medicine at Kaiser Permanente, Northern California. Again, that's Northern California. .permanente.org.
So from a practical standpoint, I'm thinking about when I do exams and the couple of times I've run across this, and you said the word, you know, if it only happens in one eye. When I do my exams, you know, I think the biggest thing I look at is it symmetrical or the same? So I was like, one eye is like white, really white, or one eye is more, you know, more reddish, but you know, is for me, the bigger thing that stands out is the fact that they look different. Like, can this present bilaterally? And if that's the case, maybe the way I think about the exam, maybe I should be thinking about other ways of doing this.
It could definitely present bilaterally, and sometimes you can see very advanced disease bilaterally where the eye looks almost completely white in both sides. I think for the most part, when you're assessing the light reflex, seeing a white reflex or leukocoria is actually quite striking. It's not like something you would see in most situations, and so it would actually stand out. Sometimes you only see it in a flash, and so you say, ooh, I'm not sure if that's real. But if you're seeing it in more than a flash, you know for sure it's abnormal, so it's something that would definitely catch your attention.
Awesome. Is there anything else we should know about presentation? You know, Trevor, you asked a bunch of good questions about, you know, proptosis and things like that. Anything else we should know about presentation? Otherwise, I might jump to pathophysiology.
Yeah, so I think on the presentation part of things, one of the things that we like to know is family history. And I think just making sure the questions are phrased well can be really helpful. So understanding if anyone in the family, asking parents if anyone in the family has had any vision-related problems, if anyone has had eye cancer, if anyone has had an eye removed and they're not sure why the eye was removed, I think that can be very, very helpful as well, because there is a huge genetic component to this condition. About 40% of people or so that present, 40% of children that present with retinoblastoma will have a hereditary germline mutation. So I think that's something that's important.
Is this more with like first degree relatives for their history, or can even more extended family history be used as we're thinking about family history?
Yeah, so definitely first-degree relatives would be the most important, but distant family members would actually be quite helpful as well. Even though it's an autosomal dominant condition, there are some low penetrance forms and there's some mosaicism that you can see. And so you might see family members without disease who are carriers passing it on. So actually, not too long ago, a few months ago, we had a child whose paternal grandmother ended up having her eye removed when she was young, but no one knew why. And when we examined the child, they had bilateral disease. We got genetic testing, and then we tested the parents, and the father also had the mutation, even though he had no evidence of retinoblastoma in his eyes.
I mean, you've already started talking a little bit about the genetics here, so I think we should just dive right in a little bit to pathophysiology behind retinoblastoma. So why are these patients getting this? Why is it so common? You know, can you kind of walk us through how this comes about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the RB gene is a tumor suppressor gene. It's located on chromosome 13 on the long arm, 13q14. And so basically, there's two ways that you can get retinoblastoma. Both require a mutation on each allele. And once that happens, then the RB suppressor gene is no longer working and you're likely to get retinoblastoma. So if this happens in a germline or hereditary form, then at some point early in the process, either passed down through one of the chromosomes of the parents or early in embryogenesis, you will have a mutation in the RB gene. And then at that point, that mutation is seen in pretty much all of the cells, unless you have mosaicism. But let's say it's seen in all of the cells. Then any mutation you get on the other allele of that gene will allow you to get multiple tumors. So that's why people who have germline mutations are more likely to have bilateral disease or multiple tumors in the eye, because the mutation is in multiple locations. It also means that these children, as they get older, are at increased risk of multiple second cancers as well. So not only are we treating for retinoblastoma, but we're also keeping in mind the increased risk for other cancers down the line. The second option is where you do not have a germline or a non-hereditary form, and that's where you get a somatic mutation in one of the alleles. That is extremely rare. Then to get a second mutation in the other allele basically means that for the most part, you're getting this in a single cell. And so that's why people with a somatic or non-hereditary retinoblastoma will have a single tumor in a single eye. So unilateral unifocal disease. Just because you have unilateral unifocal disease, though, does not guarantee that it is a non-hereditary form. About 15% of people with germline mutations will have unilateral disease. So everyone who has retinoblastoma would benefit from genetic testing to identify if they have that germline mutation. And then you can decide what to do for parents, for family members, et cetera. And I think that's critical, not only for monitoring the other eye, determining how often they need to be screened, but there's also conversations about their future second cancers, survivorship programs, and when they decide to have a family, there's a conversation that needs to happen around the likelihood of their of them passing it on.
And which one's more common? Is it more common to be the heritable or the non-heritable?
Non-heritable is more common at this point, but as we do a better job of treating retinoblastoma, especially worldwide, there will be an increase in the number of people who are surviving with retinoblastoma, and the potential to pass it on to their children may be higher. And so those numbers may change over time.
And of course, we'll probably have genetic testing then, at least in countries and medical places that have the medical resources to run genetic testing. And then we might at least, I mean, then it comes into a lot of research stuff about Li-Tai bias and things like that. But maybe we might be finding stuff or even preventing it in the future, which would be really fun. And you might be out of a job, which is even better, right?
Oh, that would be fantastic. I would absolutely love to not be working in this field.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly. Probably not too soon, though, unfortunately.
Yes, no, that's true. That's true.
And just for clarification, Dr. Williams, so when we say the heritable form, we mean that tends to usually be bilaterally, and then the sporadic tends to usually be unilaterally.
That is correct. That is most often the case, yes.
Okay. And then moving into kind of diagnosis, when we're diagnosing, so we know the red reflex, we know how to do that. And I think maybe we could use a refresher on the steps of how to do the red reflex. What would you say you would need, like an outpatient pediatrician who's caught an abnormal red reflex? What do you need them to do? Should they be like dilating the eye in the office besides sending to you? Like, should they be ordering imaging, or should they be waiting for, you know, ophthalmology to order imaging?
Right. So I would say our pediatrician colleagues have too much on their plate to be worrying about dilating the patient and trying to do a dilated exam in the office when that's not something that they would routinely be doing. So I think if they have a good, powerful light source, whether they're using a direct ophthalmoscope or a phenol light or something else, holding it at a good distance from the patient's eyes, and then just kind of watching their eyes as they move, you can definitely see the red reflex nicely in that scenario, a foot, 2 feet away from them. And sometimes you can put your finger on the light to have it kind of going on and off. So that way the patient or the child will kind of pay attention to what's going on with the light. And as you move it around, the child will move their eyes with you. So you can see the different fields of gaze, and then you can understand whether or not an abnormal reflex is present. In terms of responsibilities of the pediatrician, as soon as the white reflex is seen, having the conversation with the family and making sure they get in to see pediatric ophthalmology as quickly as possible is the most important thing. I think there's a shortage of pediatric ophthalmologists, and so sometimes the wait time can be really long. Expressing to them that there's a possibility of retinoblastoma will ensure that they get a fast appointment, or they will at least guide you to a way to get them in to be evaluated. In terms of labs and imaging, there's nothing that needs to be done at that time until the diagnosis is confirmed. When the diagnosis is confirmed, we will definitely need an MRI of the brain to make sure that there's brain involvement, and also to understand the extent of disease in the eyes to make sure that it's contained in the eyes and there's no extraocular extension. Labs we also do at the time of diagnosis, usually a CBC and a CMP, but that's because they're going to likely initiate some form of chemotherapy, and we can dive into treatment a little bit more. But in order to do that, you kind of want to have an understanding of what their baseline is. But until the diagnosis is confirmed, I think the other imaging and labs can be premature.
Okay.
Now, I was just curious from a diagnostic standpoint from your end. So, okay, you know, we saw red light reflex, you send them to you, you do a dilated exam. What do you see? How do you make that diagnosis? Or are you saying, like, I just see tumor, I don't see other stuff?
Right. Yeah. So actually, I think this is probably one of the more difficult things, especially in the ophthalmology world, because in almost every scenario, when you see cancer, you want a tissue diagnosis. In the case of retinoblastoma, by actually getting a tissue diagnosis, you're increasing the risk of extraocular extension, and you're decreasing their survival from greater than 98% in high-income countries to much lower, with the increasing their risk of metastasis. So it is predominantly a clinical diagnosis in these scenarios. There are some characteristic features that you see. So number one, we're usually doing an exam under anesthesia because these children are usually too small to be very, very cooperative with the exam. We are dilating them in that scenario. And first, we are using an indirect ophthalmoscope And a lens to examine the tumor. So there's a number of things that you would see in that situation. You often see a dilated feeding artery and dilated draining vein as the tumor grows and requires nutrients and oxygen, et cetera, et cetera. We also do imaging that is really, really helpful. Ultrasound is probably the most important imaging test we get because you can see the hyperechoic nature of calcium, and that causes shadowing. And so if you see a lesion that has calcium, a white lesion that has calcium in the retina, that is pretty much retinoblastoma 99 times out of 100. And then there are some other smaller nuanced features and other imaging that you can get to rule out other simulating conditions. But for the most part, clinical exam, ultrasound are the most important things.
And is that ultrasound that's, I assume it's POCUS, eyelid shut, ultrasound on top by you when they're under anesthesia, is that correct? Or is it you then referring them to radiology to do that?
No, we're doing that under anesthesia. That's one of the fun things about being an ophthalmologist. You do your exam, you're your own radiologist in a lot of situations. And so it's usually an eye-specific probe that you use to evaluate. And it could be eyelid, over the eyelid, or directly on the surface of the eye.
Awesome.
And you said earlier that you can, like, although rare, you can maybe catch retinoblastoma, like, in utero when they're doing ultrasounds, like, on the pregnant mother. So is that relatively common or?
No, definitely not common. Obviously, the incidence of retinoblastoma is very low. And most of the time when you're doing an ultrasound in those scenarios, you're not specifically looking for it. However, if you have a known family history, and especially if the family has opted to do any sort of genetic testing in utero, whether they get chorionic villus sampling or amniocentesis, if you have a positive mutation in that scenario, then sometimes you can do ultrasounds regularly, specifically looking for a mass and for calcification. And then depending on how things are going, you can have a conversation about whether it makes sense to deliver early for treatment, et cetera. But that is a much more rare scenario.
I have one more diagnostic question from an imaging standpoint. So the MRI, right? You're going to say, hey, I'm probably getting an MRI. You know, I imagine it's MRI orbits and brain. Can that also make the diagnosis? You know, just out of curiosity, like if you somehow have high MRI resources, but you have no pediatric ophthalmology, I don't really know where that world exists, but say you did, could that actually make a diagnosis as well?
Not quite. I mean, you could see that there's something going on in the eye. You can definitely identify that there's a retinal detachment, but clearly identifying the mass would be difficult. CT scan actually shows calcification better and would be better for diagnosis, except that CT increases the radiation, and any of these children that have a germline mutation, that puts them at higher risk of second cancers. So CT scans are actually a contraindication for children with potential retinoblastoma. So MRI is what we do. It's helpful in terms of extraocular extension, but not great for diagnosis.
I'm glad I asked. That's great.
Yeah. Didn't know that.
Absolutely.
Are there any other exams or imaging you would need to get done before you would start treatment for one of these children?
No, I think those are the most important things. I will say quickly from a diagnosis standpoint, some of the exciting things that are happening. There's a couple of apps that are using AI and large language models to help differentiate retinoblastoma from simulating conditions. And so it's really exciting as those are coming on board. And then liquid biopsy is kind of all the rage when you're thinking about oncology in general. Getting a sample of material from the aqueous, so from the front part of the eye, where usually there's no retinoblastoma present. We've actually, I got to give credit to Jess Berry's team at CHLA for developing a test that's actually able to identify nucleic acids and DNA there to be able to diagnose retinoblastoma. And it's actually recently became commercially available.
That's awesome.
I assume that's a very specific test.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cool. Chris, any more questions that you have about that? I know that's kind of your jam. Otherwise, we'll get into...
I want to know what you guys do to treat this.
Yeah. All right, let's do it.
Yeah, so absolutely. So there's been kind of a treatment arc. So obviously, enucleation or eye removal was the most common treatment for a long time, you know, from the 1860s, from when they started having anesthesia available. Somewhere in the early 1900s, we started using radiation for these children, as retinoblastoma is a very, very radiosensitive condition. But as I mentioned with CT scans, radiation increases your risk of second cancers. And so we realized that in the area area of radiation, there was a lot more osteosarcomas developing in the skull and other secondary cancers. And so when intravenous chemotherapy became a lot more popular for this in the 1990s, external beam radiation kind of went by the wayside. So obviously, intravenous chemotherapy works really well. It treats the entire body, decreases the immune system. There are some questions about whether or not it affects growth. And there were some questions about fertility, although those are mostly answered. And so it seems likely not to affect fertility much. And so that was the kind of the standard of care for a long time. And then more recently, through a special technique that was developed in Japan, intra-arterial chemotherapy became quite popular. And so you'll access the femoral artery. You will track the cannula all the way up to the ostium of the ophthalmic artery, and then you will release pulsatile chemotherapy directly to the ophthalmic artery. And that gives you about 100 times the concentration of chemotherapy directly to the eye while minimizing the systemic side effects. And so depending on resources, cost, the ability of having trained physicians to do this, that will kind of help determine whether or not intravenous or intra-arterial chemotherapy is the most commonly used treatment. Also, the benefits of intravenous chemotherapy, because it goes throughout the entire body, if you're concerned about metastasis, if you're concerned about extraocular extension, that might be the approach that you would consider. And so I think there is a nice active debate about which treatment is better, but I think each has its place depending on the situation. And even enucleation or eye removal is still appropriate if disease is very advanced, especially if it's so advanced that the long-term opportunity for vision is not going to be good.
So in your own personal practice, what would you say is like the percentage of patients that go down each of these paths, just for us to sort of understand a little bit more currently in 2025? In Florida.
yeah, absolutely. So I would say probably 5% or less of patients are getting enucleation. And these are patients who present with very, very advanced disease. Sometimes these are patients that are from disadvantaged backgrounds with limited access to care, people who are traveling from very far away, people who live in rural areas and have not that many ophthalmologists, especially pediatric ophthalmologists around, or some of our patients who travel internationally from the Caribbean, etc. I would say split between intra-arterial and systemic or intravenous chemotherapy, probably we're doing about 80% intra-arterial chemotherapy right now, even for bilateral conditions. But I think that varies from center to center.
And this is just my own question, and we can always, it's probably not as applicable to our general audience, but when you're doing this intra-arterial chemotherapy, which regimen are you using? Is there a specific regimen that we're using across the board? I'm just curious more from a side effect standpoint. We'll just start with that.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So I'm going to actually go back to systemic or intravenous chemotherapy and say that there is a pretty standard therapy that has been developed through the Children's Oncology Group, through the COG, of using vincristine, etoposide, and carboplatin. And that ranges in how many sessions you do, with many people doing about 6 sessions. Intra-arterial chemotherapy was never actually prospectively studied. And so it was actually just done. And so we don't know the correct answer to this. So if you talk to each center, they will have a little bit of a different regimen. There are 3 medications that are predominantly used, melphalan, topotecan, and carboplatin. Melphalan, I would say, is the most commonly used medication and is probably the most potent. And then usually people add topotecan to that if there's more advanced disease, and then add carboplatin on top as a third option if there's really advanced disease. If there's disease in both eyes, because melphalan, even if it's given intra-arterially, can cause some toxicity, they will sometimes split melphalan in one eye and topotecan and carboplatin in the other eye to try and reduce the chemotoxicity.
Awesome. And then for all our listeners, you know, you guys, we don't need to talk about the side effects of platins and you know, the TCANs and things like that, but that's at least a good background for us who might be interested can go look those up on the side and talk about that. If you've ever listened to a heart murmur and thought, did I really hear that? You're not alone. I've had moments in the wards where I thought I caught something subtle, maybe a faint gallop or an irregular rhythm, but with background noise, a restless patient, and no time for a second opinion, I just had to move on. That's where Echo Health came in. Being able to record the sound meant I could revisit it later, and with the help of Echo's AI, I got confirmation that what I heard wasn't just in my head. It's like having a second set of expert ears, even after you've left the room. So Echo combines the stethoscope you already know with enhanced audio and advanced AI to help you detect heart and lung conditions earlier, and with more confidence. With Echo, you can hear with precision, even in noisy environments. Their digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and noise cancellation cuts out distractions. You can also detect disease earlier. Unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording, sharing, and more for earlier diagnoses and seamless collaborations. And lastly, it improves diagnostic accuracy. Backed by millions of heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms, clinical studies show that those who use Echo are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. And a personal benefit? Teaching. I've used Echo recordings to walk learners through abnormal heart and lung sounds, and even to help patients better understand what's going on with their own bodies. It turns the stethoscope from a black box into a real-time teaching tool. So we trust Echo so much that we worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/cribsiders. Your purchase may be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. And if you don't, return it for a full refund. So again, go to echohealth.com/cribsiders for up to $50 off, plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/cribsiders. You know, what does the treatment regimen look like? You know, you mentioned, okay, we're going to do chemotherapy, you know, intravenously, maybe 6 sessions. You know, what are we talking about here for how long this goes on?
That's a fantastic question. So obviously most of this, or at least your treatment decision, is based on how advanced disease is and what stage it is. There are some local treatments that you can do, laser, freezing with cryotherapy, or even local radiation with a plaque, which reduces the risk of radiation to other parts of the eye. So if you have minimal or not very advanced disease, you would do those treatments. We do our exams under anesthesia about every 4 weeks, and we usually time our chemotherapy sessions with those. So we'll see the patient, examine how they've been doing, and then admit them for systemic chemotherapy if that's what they're going to get, or if they're getting intra-arterial, either our interventional neuroradiologist or our neurosurgeon will then do the procedure either under the same session of anesthesia or on, you know, one of the few days afterwards, and then we'll see them 3 to 4 weeks later. Actually, there's been some studies that have shown by waiting 35 days or more in between sessions that actually increases your risk of recurrence. So we really want to keep things on a tight schedule.
So it sounds like intra-arterial can be mostly all outpatient, whereas intravenous, it does sound like they're going to have to spend some time in the hospital while they get their beds.
Yes, that's definitely true. But I would say, you know, a lot of these children and families are quite acquainted with the hospital, even when it's a lot of outpatient therapy, because they are there for treatment monthly. And then, you know, after they're out of treatment, you still kind of slowly extend the visit. So we're talking about many, many sessions of anesthesia. There's one other thing about treatment that I should mention. Most of this disease can be contained in the retina, but the biggest challenge is vitreous seeding. So little buds of tumor that float off of the main tumor. They're then no longer connected to the blood supply, and so they may not respond as well to some of the treatments that are going through the blood supply. So we do occasionally do intravitreal chemotherapy, where we give injections of chemo directly into the eye to take care of those vitreous seeds.
Wow, that's crazy. Looking at as the general pediatrician now, I see my patient, they've been diagnosed with retinoblastoma, they're going through one of the treatment options that you've given them. What are the things that I need to be worried about in terms of complications? It sounds like intra-arterial, I may not have to worry about a lot of those systemic chemotherapy effects, but are those things I still have to worry about as well?
Yes, I think those are definitely things that you still have to pay attention to. So I would say, most of the eye-related side effects and complications, the ophthalmologist or ocular oncologist is going to be taken care of. And so I think you don't necessarily need to focus as heavily on those. However, I think conversation with the family about what's going on can be important. Sometimes the family will talk to the pediatrician and say, oh, after last treatment, the eyelid was down. And by the time they come to see the ophthalmologist, things look back to normal. And so those kind of things are definitely important. Looking at systemic side effects, the neutropenia, the increased risk of fever, et cetera, are things to pay attention to as well. And then there's obviously the conversations around chemotherapy, what to do about timing of vaccinations, how to think about the rest of their medical history and what's going on there. And then I think, you know, sometimes we're so focused on the cancer side from the ophthalmology perspective, we also have to think about overall child health. So if you have one eye that's severely affected by retinoblastoma, children need to be wearing protective glasses because we need to do as much as possible to protect the good eye. So those kind of conversations as well.
I have a question about actually kind of going off of that. So I know you said that enucleation is usually only like maybe 5% of the cases of this, that would be the curative treatment. I actually had the opportunity to see an enucleated like patient one time when I did an ophthalmology rotation in medical school. It might not be common, but is there like guidelines? Let's say like there is a kid that has their eye enucleated and they go to their pediatrician for their well child check. Like I know that enucleation, they wear prosthetic eyes. I don't know what it's made of, but you can take it out, like things like that, just for general knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you do an enucleation, you remove the eye, you put an implant inside, you attach the muscles to the implant, and then you kind of close things up. So there should be some good movement there. On top of that is a prosthesis, which is basically like a thick painted contact lens that the child can take in and out or the adult can take in and out. In general, when you see a lot of mucus or discharge, it's worthwhile having the conversation with them about how often they're taking it out, whether or not they're cleaning it, etc. In the young children, we recommend taking it out maybe about once a month because it can be somewhat traumatic for them. But as they get older, taking it out every other week or maybe even every week can be a little bit more reasonable. Most of the kids, though, as they get more comfortable with it, are okay to take it out themselves by the time they get to 3 or 4 years old. And some of them will even play games or play tricks on their classmates by taking it out and scaring them, et cetera.
I want to talk about survivorship in a minute. I just want to make sure that, was there anything else you want us and our listening audience to know about management and treatment that you want, that or your the general pediatricians out there, the primary care, the family docs, like, is there anything else you want us to know during this, during treatment and management?
Yeah, I think there is one thing that's really important. There are very few centers that take care of patients with retinoblastoma. And so patients will often be traveling very far to see their ocular oncologist or their ophthalmologist to do this. And so oftentimes when they're done with the active treatment phase and done with some of their follow-up, they might try and transition care back home. And sometimes they may get lost to follow-up, but they will still follow up with their pediatrician. And so I think making sure to have an open and candid conversation with them about making sure they're continuing their follow-up can be really important. Even if they don't want to travel far away, following up with their local ophthalmologist, making sure they're getting eye exams is really critical.
And how often should those be? So, you know, say, you know, child is in survivorship, they're done with their chemotherapy, you know, they're more in more remote follow-ups with their, you know, their specialists for retinoblastoma. How often that should they be seeing their maybe local ophthalmologist if they've sort of taken over that care, and how often should we be pushing them to be seen?
Yeah, so I would say a minimum of once a year, and that's for life. Retinoblastoma can recur. Even though it's very, very rare, the vast majority of recurrences, so 99% of recurrences happen within the first 3 years of completing treatment. But I have seen a patient that was last treated at 3 years old develop a recurrence at 18. I've seen someone else later in adulthood as well. So at least once a year, follow-up with the ophthalmologist is important.
And then with the radiation concern you said for some of our patients, like, is this something we have to talk about the rest of their life? Because I don't know if this is something that I've thought about. It's like, oh, you have a pneumonia. Maybe I should bring out my ultrasound to look at your lungs instead of order the chest x-ray because your history of retinoblastoma. Is that something I need to be thinking about?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question too. I think the vast majority of the radiation risk and concern is when they're quite young. So less than 1 year old is the highest risk of that extra radiation being problematic. And that kind of decreases over time. By the time they get to 5 years old or so, then the risk is much, much lower. So I don't think in your adult patients, you should be necessarily worried about, oh, I didn't ask them if they have a history of retinoblastoma or a germline mutation. You can kind of go through your normal protocols.
And I think along the survivorship questions, you know, that Chris was bringing up, we should talk about the germline piece, the risk for other tumors. This is retinoblastoma is a tumor suppressor gene. Can you kind of walk us through what those other secondary cancers we should be, or not necessarily secondary cancers, but other primaries that we should be worried about and how we should screen for it?
Yeah, so these second primary malignancies range quite a bit. So if patients have had radiation, and usually these are older patients now, since we haven't been doing radiation as part of routine therapy for some time now, we'd be thinking about osteosarcoma and other things like that. Now it's more epithelial tumors. But truthfully, based on some of the guidelines that have come out, that does not happen at a high enough rate that it warrants imaging screening on a routine basis. So it's just a matter of kind of checking in with the survivorship doctor and kind of having the conversation about how everything is going, but paying attention to new symptoms and changes and then going with screening. But prophylactic screening or imaging recommendations are not in place.
Gotcha. So it's kind of almost reversed, like in the sense that you're just doing routine cancer screening, whatever it may be, as they get older. And then if they ended up with another cancer, you'd be like, oh, it's probably because they had an RB gene problem and yada, yada, yada. But you couldn't do anything ahead of time is what it sounds like.
It doesn't seem to be worth it from the number of from the amount of imaging required and the cost to the system and the rarity of the disease to do it.
And so from a genetic testing standpoint, too, it sounds like that is also more useful for, for family planning and things like that, more than it's useful for finding these secondary tumors. Or am I actually misinterpreting that?
So what I would say is actually genetic testing is critical for all of those things. If you have retinoblastoma, testing the child and testing the family, so you understand their risk of retinoblastoma, you understand how often they need to be followed from the eye exam standpoint and for life, and to understand and have a conversation with them that they have an increased risk of second cancers. And so if they notice something going on, they should go in kind of more readily.
Who's doing that genetic testing? Is it the ophthalmologist or is it the oncologist, or do they like have a geneticist that usually manages all of that?
Great question, and that varies per center. So in a lot of places, the ophthalmologist is drawing blood at the time of the exam under anesthesia and sending it out for genetic testing then. In other locations, the medical oncologist does it, and then if you're at a bigger children's hospital, you can have a geneticist that will kind of go over those results and keep in close contact with the patient as well. So this is one of the most important multidisciplinary disease processes that we treat, that we deal with, and so kind of having everyone on the team involved is critical.
So I want to go into, looking ahead now for our survivors of retinoblastoma and thinking about their prognosis and things they need to think about the rest of their life. One question I want to first ask is, as they get older, should they get genetic counseling before they decide that they want to have their own kids? Is that something they need to worry about?
Absolutely. That is one of the most important conversations to have. And so obviously you have the conversation about genetics with the family when they're young, but they're so young that this is not a relevant conversation to them if they're able to understand what's going on at that time. I continually have this conversation as children get older, in their 10 teenage years, et cetera, because there are various age ranges where people might become parents. And so I always let them know if there's a possibility you might be a parent in the future, this is something that we should be talking about, and kind of talk to them about the risk of passing it on. Some of that is done with the genetics team, the genetic counselors, and some of that is done with me, because as they get older, it becomes harder and harder for them to keep all of these appointments in their everyday life. But usually I'm one of the people that they continue to see, so I do have that conversation. I also encourage them to be open about this with their partners, because there's definitely been a number of times where I've seen someone who had an eye removed and they have a child with retinoblastoma, and the partner will say, oh, I wonder how they got this. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. This conversation hasn't been had in the background. And so I think sometimes people don't even think about that. And so that's why it's important to have these conversations with patients as they get older.
Anything else we need to know in terms of prognosis for these patients, looking at them long-term?
Yeah, I think one of the things that parents want to know from the very beginning is how well is their child going to see and how well are they going to be able to function in everyday life. And a lot of this is dependent on where the tumor is located. If the tumor is located directly in the center of vision, it is likely that they are going to have some level of decreased vision in that eye. even though we have some remarkable outcomes after treatment, if the tumor is located in the periphery and away from the center part of the vision, the vast majority of time, they end up having pretty good vision. If an eye has to be removed, and that's the only eye that was involved, they are able to live completely normal lives, see extremely well, drive, do almost every activity that everyone else can do except maybe be a fighter pilot. And so I actually expressed this to them early on so that because a lot of times, you know, these children are living their lives and they're doing quite well, but the parents have a lot of anxiety and that can be transmitted to the children or the family. And so I think when you can appropriately decrease that anxiety, I think it's really valuable to do.
Yeah, 100%. Is there any exciting research on the horizon, like with treatment or, I don't know, maybe earlier detection?
Yeah, so I think the liquid biopsy stuff is really, really exciting. The team at Memorial Sloan Kettering is looking at liquid biopsy from the blood standpoint. The team at CHLA has done a great job with liquid biopsy from the aqueous. And so I think as we get to understand that a little bit better, it becomes more than just making the diagnosis, but perhaps who responds to what kind of treatment, who's more likely to require enucleation, who's going to be more chemosensitive, those kind of thing. So I think those are really, really exciting. And we continue to improve our medications. So intravitreal injections, there's new medications that we're using with less side effects and similar efficacy. So I think all of these things are really exciting. And as we improve our delivery methods, we will be able to reduce our side effects and improve vision more. So it's a really, really exciting time to be somebody that that works in the retinoblastoma space.
Are these, I know you mentioned intravitreal injections, are these like down the line as they grow older into their 20s, 30s, 40s, are they ever going to need, like, will a complication arise from the retinoblastoma that they would need an injection for or something like that?
Yeah, so that is definitely possible. I mean, so retinoblastoma, as tumors grow, they can leak and they can cause exudation, basically causing a retinal detachment. By treatment alone, that usually gets rid, but just by treating the cancer, it usually gets rid of most of the retinal detachment. However, long-term retinal detachment or very large tumors can lead to ischemia, and sometimes treatment can lead to ischemia too. And that ischemia can have side effects and sometimes lead to the growth of abnormal blood vessels that sometimes require laser, sometimes require injections as these children get older as well.
And then what would you say, Dr. Williams, would be like some of your main take-home points that you want our listeners to bring with them after listening to our episode?
Yeah, I think there's something that I have not mentioned that I think is also really important. And I think pediatricians know this well. I've learned this definitely taking care of kiddos with retinoblastoma. Listen to the parents. They often know what's going on. When they say something is off or they say they've seen something, sometimes even if the abnormal, if the light reflex isn't abnormal, but the parents say, oh, I definitely noticed something, then I would say, move forward with that and say, I didn't necessarily see it, but I think it's worth an evaluation for retinoblastoma. I would say the light reflex is a really, really important test and probably the most important thing that we can do to take care of these children, because earlier diagnosis leads to better visual outcomes and more lives saved, more eyes saved, and better vision. And then I think just making sure that we take care of them as a whole patient, kind of thinking about the family, thinking about the siblings who are going with them to these visits and making sure they're doing well, making sure they feel part of a team. You know, all of that is really, really critical also.
Basil, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. I think I learned more about retinoblastoma than I have ever known, ever. So I think I learned a lot. I'm very sure that our listeners learned a whole bunch as well.
Well, I thank you so much for having me, and I definitely must say I thank my patients. As they get older, well, many of them from the very beginning when they come in and give me a high five, and they're the most cheerful people despite everything that's going on. It is really, really inspiring, and I really have learned so much from them. And a few of them, as they've gotten older, we keep very, very in very, very close contact. So I thank them. I thank their families for giving me the opportunity to take care of them.
And before we sign off, is there anything you want to plug for our listeners to check out?
No, I don't think so. I think you have a fantastic podcast, and I think actually just listening to you all on a regular basis will be quite informative. And I might be one of those people that checks in from time to time just to improve my knowledge base. Thanks so much for what you do.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. This has been absolutely fantastic. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Williams. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer, Dr. Trevor Hogue, for this episode, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I'm Trevor.
And this has been Chris the Chew Man Chew. Thank you, and good night. And now, for those who've made it to the end, now you're going to be blessed with a poem written by AI. Title's called The Light in the Eye. A gleaming white reflex catches the light where darkness should dwell in pupils at night. Retinoblastoma silent and small, behind innocent eyes stand cruelly tall. Through red reflex screening, we search with care for cat's eye reflection that shouldn't be there. From family photos that capture a glow to clinic exams where concerns may grow. RB1 gene, guardian of sight, when mutations occur, cells lose their light. Two-hit hypothesis guides what we know from sporadic cases to those that seed slow. Some bilateral, some in one eye alone. Staging guides whether the eye can be shown. Mercy through focus therapies new or enucleations difficult do. Through fundoscopic views, we may find calcifications that may help us remind. These tumors need teams of seasoned expertise, oncologists, surgeons working with ease. From systemic chemo to focused beams, intra-arterial paths, and cryo dreams, the goal remains constant, life first, then sight, for children whose futures should still shine bright. Thank you. Good night, guys.